I have had somebody say, like, why can't we make jokes? I always call my friend Fags. It's just how they grew up. And I'm like, you know what? There's 12,000 people in my local union. The percentage of LGBTQ people, I think it's 4%. There's definitely not 400 to 500 people out at IBEW. And so until those people feel like they can come out and be comfortable and safe coming out, being their own person, that language is done.
They're proud to have earned a strong record of working with skilled union labor to build the country's first wind farm, where they employed more than 300.
We're unionizing because it's just consistent with our values. Like, we are an organization that stands beside other workers and fights for workers' rights.
If you're in San Francisco, if you're in Manhattan, there are musicians leaving in droves. Artists, wow. Actors, dancers going back to their hometowns.
What happens if you don't have an adequately sourced public defense bar is essentially what we like to refer to as guilty plea mills.
Going from 14 in the House to 12, that's a significant problem for other legislators on the Democratic side, but also for the people of Idaho that do want to improve education, that do want to see more labor unions, that do want to have minimum wage.
In fact, if you take a look at our Constitution, you'll notice that we, the people, are the biggest words on it.
Now is the time to unite. Take a stand for children's rights. To dream, to learn, to play. To grow in safety day by day. We all must do our part. To give these lives a brand new start. On the future's defend. Defend. Reach our labor to win. Now, it's time to take a stand.
Welcome to the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. This week on Unify, a Young Workers podcast, the IBEW's Cheryl Perrin talks about diversity, inclusion, and women in the trades. Then, on UCOM Live, the building trades secure a deal to build offshore wind plants. And what happens when workers at a community nonprofit join a union and try to negotiate a first contract? Labor Radio finds out during a visit with CWA organizer Koya Crespin. On Union City Radio, a kids group releases a brand new song dedicated to the International Year for the Elimination of Child Labor. With entertainment venues shut down across the country, how are union musicians doing these days? American Federation of Musicians Local 4 President Leonard DiCosimo discusses how musicians are faring during the pandemic on America's Workforce Union podcast. On We Do the Work, John Kormorowski, retired chief public defender of Whatcom County, Washington, explains why public defenders are so important to the justice system. Carrie Stenick, campaign manager for recent races for both the federal House and state Senate in Idaho, provides her insights into the Idaho and national political landscape on the Labor Line show. We wrap up this week's show with an excerpt from a recent podcast extra from the En Masse podcast, as host Liz Medina, who's also acting director of the Vermont AFL-CIO, joined other speakers and singer Heidi Ann Wilson during a Protect the Results vigil in front of Vermont State House on November 4th. I'm Chris Garlock, and that's all ahead on today's Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, bringing you working people's voices with a selection of highlights from the Labor Radio Podcast Network. Here's the show.
Hello, welcome to Unify Young Workers Podcast. My name's Cara Brudeau, and thanks so much for listening to this episode. We have Cheryl Perrin. She works for the First District of International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, which is basically the international office in all of Canada. And the cool thing about Cheryl is she's not your typical electrician. She worked for NAV Canada, and she also explained that in the podcast. But yeah, this is my first in-person interview, and I think you can tell just for the simple fact that it flows a little easier think we feed off each other a little bit better than the online interviews that I've had in the past. All right. This is my friend Cheryl Perrin. So do you want to tell the people what you do for a living?
Sure. I work for the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers, where I work on diversity and inclusion initiatives. And our two big programs are NextGen, which caters to young workers age 35 and under, and our Women in Trades and Underrepresented Groups. So both programs are a lot of fun, and I've met Kara through those programs, and so I'm just excited to be here today.
Awesome. I think construction's been really interesting for me because there's been such a plethora of educators that I've come across. Some have been so inspirational, and then some I'm just like, what are you doing here? One guy, my favorite, was at the very beginning of the class, was telling a story about he was on just an abortion of a job site. And I was like, there's three chicks in here, and you're gonna call a job site an abortion in front of a room full of 20 people? Come on. There's jokes that you can say between two people that are a lot funnier, and read the room. Anyways, he pissed me off the whole
That, language like that is not appropriate in a classroom ever.
No.
Or on a job site.
Well,
that's one of the big things that we try and push and facilitate conversations around, changing the culture of construction. And easier said than done, of course.
Way easier. I feel like we have a lot of resistance.
Yes and no. I've had really inspiring conversations that I've been a part of and that were driven by men, that were driven by young workers.
Love it.
And just how that they're not okay with the culture on construction sites. And one of them has a couple daughters. And it was just making that connection of, okay, this is not something that I would want my child going into.
Right. Man or female.
Man or woman. Yeah. It was really great to hear that conversation. And it completely came up from them. It wasn't something that I probed them on and they ran with it. No, they brought it up as an issue that they wanted to discuss. And I think I had tears in my eyes at the time because it was just so great to hear. This is what we're trying to do and this is what we want to see. And so I think there are those opinions out there. Mm-hmm. But it's maybe the loudest opinions on the construction site are still the old school
woman, you better make my lunch.
Yeah, you know? Just the old ways, I guess, that have no place anymore.
No, it's so one thing I brought up was somebody at my job site, and I know some of the people thought I was being a prude. So we have an acronym that's not official.
Do you remember resistor color codes?
No.
Okay.
There's several, apparently.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, yes. No, I've heard of a few of those. Yeah, I don't remember them.
We'll not repeat them because they should not be repeated. But
no. So fire alarm guy, fag. So somebody the other day was like, hand me the fag drawing. And I was like, oh, it says fire alarm guy drawing on it? Is that what it says? And I got so angry because I work with a gay man. And I'm like, you know what? I don't even care that some people say this. If this person heard you say that, how are they going to feel? They're going to know that you're not talking about them, but it's still the fact of the matter is it's not something that needs to be said. It's not something I'm going to let you say around me. And I made my foreman make an announcement about how it's not appropriate.
Good for you.
And I told my steward too, because there's been so much shit happening with the nooses that were found on the construction sites.
Yeah.
And that was my same company that the first one happened at.
Elliston?
Yes, I'm working at the courthouse downtown, which is Elliston, but it's Univex.
Okay.
And it has nothing to do with the company itself. Like, it's a company from Ottawa. All the guys are union guys. So it's not even like a company culture as far as I could see. But it's still just like one of those things that, like, it's still so close to home. We had to be inclusive of everybody. And it's like you said, there's some cultures that things are just okay to say to certain groups of people. And then to somebody like me, it's really not.
It's a work site, right? You're at a job, you're a professional, you should be acting like one and using professional language. And what people do when they're in their own time with their, you know, own friends and family is their business. If you're coming to work every day, you should be professional. And you shouldn't be saying things that other people can take inappropriately or offensively.
Yeah.
Just stay clear of that language. That's the easiest thing to do. And I don't think that's too much to ask of people who come to work every day.
I don't think so either. But to some people, they act like we're taking away their rights. And I think freedom of speech means that we don't throw you in jail for saying the wrong thing. I don't think it means you're allowed to say whatever the hell you want all the time.
Yeah, I think I support freedom of speech, but it's, you know, also respectful freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, so it's, I think, like you said, just people can say what they want at home. That's their own business. But at work, it does need to be professional. And I have had somebody say, like, why can't we make jokes? I always call my friend fags. Just, it's just how they grew up. And I'm like, you know what? There's 12,000 people in my local union. And I think what's the percentage of LGBTQ people? I think it's 4% or something like that. There's definitely not 400 to 500 people out at IBEW. And so until those people feel like they can come out and be comfortable and safe coming out, being their own person, that language is done, like, as far as I'm concerned. Thank you for your inspirational words. Love it. I appreciate you sitting down with me.
Oh, thank you for having me. This has been a pleasure.
Yeah, my first in-person podcast interview.
Hanging out in a beautiful park.
Yes.
6 feet apart.
Yeah, more or less. And sitting on a blanket. Two blankets, actually. All right, awesome.
Coming to you live from the UConn Media Studios in New York, it's UConn Live with Chris LaGrange. News, talk, sports, and workforce politics. The loudest, strongest, and most controversial labor news show on, in, and around the internet. Now here's your host, Chris LaGrange.
So the building trades secure a memorandum of understanding for the wind energy work here in Nueva York, New Jersey, Northeast section. Smart and historic, Local 3 IBEW is a driving force behind that. What's up, everybody? I'm Chris LaGrange with UCOM Live with me, Chris LaGrange, News Talk Sports, Workforce Politics, the most controversial labor news show on, in, and around the internet. Two people clap. Me, you know it all, Brian, James, and Skippy Ding Dongs running around doing God knows what. Okay, the story behind the story on wind farms.
Yeah, so the building trades and Ørsted reached a deal to use union labor to build offshore wind. Ørsted is the largest offshore wind producer in the country.
In the world.
I just know in the United States, they're the largest offshore wind. They have contracts currently to build 2.9 gigawatts of offshore wind between Maryland.
You know how much a gigawatt is? That's the moon produces a gigawatt.
Oh, you could travel in time with that.
Anyway, go ahead.
Ørsted is going to partner with the building trades unions to begin retraining members and training new apprentices so that they can work on the offshore wind. And according to the Wind Energy Association, currently there are 15 commercial leases in U.S. waters, and that's going to create 83,000 jobs,
wow,
30 gigawatts of power, and $25 billion in annual economic output over the next 10 years.
Anyway. Love about this is that the unions here in Nueva York were really behind making it happen in ways that I can't even tell you. Ways that I shouldn't even know. And this is good because can you imagine having something like this built by a substandard, unskilled labor? Can you imagine the trauma and the absolute turmoil of people fighting over getting this types of work? You want stability when going out and doing a high-profile job like this, especially when it's creating 1.1 million gigawatts, which can power a small city.
30 gigawatts.
What is it?
30 gigawatts over the next 10 years.
30 gigs. That's a lot of energy. That's a lot. That's a game changer. That's a big deal. And who's delivering this? This is all private industry. Had nothing to do with that moron that was in the White House for the past 4 years.
He was actively trying to block it. Ørsted just said in a statement that they believe the best workers are always the best trained workers, and they're proud to have earned a strong record of working with skilled union labor to build the country's first wind farm, where they employed more than 300. And they appreciate the building trades cooperation and collaboration approach that the union partners have brought to the endeavor.
But good job, National North American Building Trades. Even though you guys are getting credit for it, I know who really made this happen. Awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Center of the world, you guys are. So goes local. So goes the American Union Movement. You know who you are. So awesome. Awesome, awesome, awesome. Good enough show. 5:30 now?
We made it, yes.
Okay, I gotta not forget my watch. All right, so remember, the only crime you can commit is doing nothing. Silence means consent, so make some noise in the presence of evil injustice. Care more about your community and less about your guns, because your guns will never love you back. And thank you for being the change this November. Thanks for stopping by, America. And to the good people of North Arlington, New Jersey, thank you for your support. I'm Chris LaGrange. This was UCOM Live. And we'll try this again next week. Happy Thanksgiving.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, and welcome to Labor Radio, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. I'm Amanda Hill, here with my co-host, Jamie Partridge. Hello, Jamie.
Hey, Amanda.
How's it going?
It's another day in paradise.
Yeah, I bet. Tonight, we're here with Koya Crespin with the Community Alliance of Tenants Labor Union and AJ Mendoza of the Communication Workers of America Local 7901, with which the CAT Labor Union is affiliated. Union busting at the Community Alliance of Tenants, a weird concept. A respected membership organization dedicated to organizing for renters' rights on the side of working class renters against abusive landlords has paid for one of the worst corporate union busters in town. Koya, could you tell us what's going on there? CAT's been without a unionized workforce for decades. Now, in the last few months, you've organized and are confronted with a union buster. What's that been like?
As you can imagine, it's been pretty terrible. As a community organizer, and like a lot of us, I organize in the community that I struggle in and that I want to make better. And to work for an organization that is actively participating in this is really disheartening, and it really took the wind out of me. It made me depressed. Like, you go through all these feelings of just being sad because I put a lot of myself in my work. I feel like I do speak for for the rest of the union when I say we are really sad that we're in this situation.
So tell us, why did you unionize in the first place? What are you asking for? What are you looking for at the bargaining table?
Definitely, we're unionizing because it's just consistent with our values. Like, we are an organization that stands beside other workers and fights for workers' rights and acknowledges these intersectionalities in between the tenant union and the labor rights, the tenant rights movement and the labor rights movement. We organize because I feel like it's a very important part of my legacy as an organizer, and what I'd like to hand on it to the next generation of organizers is a solid foundation in labor rights.
So in the world of nonprofits, we're all expected to work extra hours, like you were just saying, and do away with the compensation. Why do you think so many nonprofits are now deciding that unionizing is the way to go? What's the tipping point where they realize that they don't need to give away their time the way they have been?
The nonprofit sector generally is just not paid at the market rate. There's this culture of, generally speaking, like a take one for the team. And eventually it just means everyone is just taking one, and then everyone's taking two, and then so on and so forth. And you get to this horrific point where it is not a standard in nonprofits that a COLA is there. So there is, in real terms, like nonprofit workers that are asked to take a pay cut every year because their wages don't even keep up with inflation, which is just so, it feels so wrong because the people, nobody deserves to live in poverty. That's just, put that out there. But it is, it's so hard when there's people that have that good urge to want to help, that are passionate about something that's bigger than themselves. And that is what is taken and ran with and abused. And that there is, I think it's just gotten to the point where someone's got to give. And that moment is, and seeing somebody else do it, like seeing that it's possible, is also the different moment than we were at like 10 years ago.
Speaking of cat funds, I think that the word is that these union busters are being paid something like $380 an hour to manipulate this process. And as a cat member myself, I'm outraged. Anyway, so moving back to our guests.
How can our listeners get in touch with you and keep updated on Clue's struggle?
So we have a Facebook page, and we have it's Cat Labor Union. That's okay. What it is, AJ?
Yeah, and the Instagram too is the same one.
Cat Labor Union, hit us up if you want to get to know us. We would like to get to know you. Follow us. We're fighting for tenants' rights and worker rights.
And that wraps it up for Labor Radio this Monday and every Monday, 6 o'clock on KBO Portland. You've been listening to Community Alliance of Tenants Labor Union member Koya Crespin and president of the Communication Workers of America, Local 7901, AJ Mendoza.
Welcome to Union City Radio for Saturday, November 28th. This is Chris Garlock with the latest labor news, updates, and history from the Metro Washington Labor Council.
A back is aching from a long day's work. There is so much that she must clean. And her employers wasted no kind words. For today she turns 13. He has a story that millions of children share. We must come together, but there's no time to spare.
That's from the new song, Take a Stand, by the band Kids United Nouvelle Génération, dedicated to the International Year for the Elimination of Child Labor in 2021. The song was created in collaboration with the International Labor Organization and released on November 20th, Universal Children's Day. The ILO supports its member states in the elimination of child labor through the development and implementation of laws and policies to combat the problem. And though much still remains to be done, over the years, significant progress has been made in the fight against child labor, benefiting millions of children. Find out more at ILO.org/child labor. That's LABOUR. In today's labor history, on this date in 1828, William Silvis, founder of the National Labor Union, was born. Today's labor quote is the stirring chorus from Take a Stand. Union City Radio is supported by our friends at Union Plus. Find out more at unionplus.org.
This has been Chris Garlock. See you on the line.
Because the union, the union will make us strong. It will make us strong.
Welcome to the America's Workforce Radio Podcast, the flagship production of the American Workers Radio and Podcast Network, where organized labor and its never-ending fight to protect the rights of the American worker.
Today on the show, we talk about COVID's effect on the musical arts. Good afternoon and welcome to the Wednesday, November 25th edition of America's Workforce, where we are available on various platforms. Let's go to line number two. Welcome back to the show. Love this guy, Len DeCosimo. He heads the Local 4, the American Federation of Musicians. It's actually the Cleveland, Ohio Federation of Musicians. Local4MusicFund.org is their website. And here we are in the middle of a pandemic, and boy, I tell you, for local musicians, artists, my God, it's been very difficult trying to make a living. What are you going to do when all the venues close down? They open it up to limited capacity, and now they're on the verge of closing down again. Len DeCosimo, I know it's a day before Thanksgiving, and sometimes I scratch my head. I'm wondering, geez, this has been a rough year. I know we're supposed to sit down and give thanks, and we have to reflect. At least we're here to talk about it, but hopefully better times will be ahead. How you doing, my friend?
Slash, happy Thanksgiving. We're trying to focus on what to be thankful for again this year.
Yeah. All right. Talk to me. We're approaching, obviously, the holiday season with Thanksgiving starting tomorrow, Christmas right around the corner. And this is a time where a lot of local musicians make some good bucks. Well, that's not going to happen. What's the alternative here? I know we've had several conversations over the last couple of months about virtual. It's not the same, but you got to do something. What's going to happen here, Len?
First off, you're right that it's not going to be the same. In fact, it wasn't even going to be what we thought it was just a few weeks ago, Flash, with the spike in the COVID numbers, not only in this state, which is rising dramatically, much more than the rest of the country, but also with the venues where musicians perform, as large as Severance Hall, as small as the local club that hires the local artists. So we had been preparing for the Cleveland Orchestra to have performances at Severance Hall, and we all collectively decided that wasn't going to be the case this year. And that's going to be one of the factors that we're dealing with when our second settlement expires at the end of January.
I was just going to ask you, how do we compare to other cities around the country? I know you reach out the New Yorks, the Los Angeleses, the Chicagos. Obviously, same kind of scenario there. The pandemic has touched every corner of the country, some worse than others. But how are they holding up as well?
What's interesting is in the classical realm, whether it's symphony, operatic, repertoire, there are two views. And one is, fortunately, what we have in Cleveland with Musical Arts Association and the orchestra, that we've reached two very good settlements this year that provide for the musicians to still receive a salary, to still provide them work, to maintain their health benefits and all the other things at a bit of a reduced rate so everybody can survive on the other side. And we're very grateful. And I've emphasized that before. However, Flash, it doesn't matter what the scale is, whether it's Manhattan, New York City, and the Met Opera, or a smaller regional ensemble like the Fort Wayne Philharmonic or the Colorado Springs Philharmonic Orchestra, where they just furlough the musicians. Doesn't matter what's in their endowment. Doesn't matter how much money they received in the CARES Act. They cut loose all of the artists, cut loose all of the production staff, cut loose all of the people who make the arts work with the expectation that you'll be there on the other side.
That's crazy.
What's been happening that's different in the larger versus smaller markets is that the musicians and the artists that live in smaller markets can pretty much afford to live where they are because the cost of living is lower. But, man, if you're in San Francisco, if you're in Manhattan, there are musicians leaving in droves. Artists, actors, dancers, going back to their hometowns, talking to my members here as well, which is to this market, which is much smaller, looking for other lines of work, going back to their even smaller markets where they came from. It's a real interesting migration pattern that is unveiling this year.
We'll definitely keep our eye on it. Len, I'm going to leave it on that note. Len DeCosimo, who is president of Local 4 of the Cleveland Federation of Musicians. He's also the director of music at the Pilgrim Church in Tremont, Ohio, and the choral director at Lakeland Community College. A man with many hats. Got a passion for music, no doubt about that. You take care. Be safe. Happy Thanksgiving to you. And we'll be talking down the road, my friend, all right?
Love you, Flash. Happy Thanksgiving, brother.
That's it for another edition of America's Workforce.
That concludes another episode of the America's Workforce Radio Podcast. Thanks for listening. And be sure to subscribe so you never miss a show. America's Workforce is a production of Labor Tools and BMA Media Group. Find out more information online at labortools.com.
We dig the ditch. We train the tire. We teach the kids. We lend a hand.
As we have said many times over the years, We Do the Work is here for you, the American worker. In this time of great challenge, when the corona pandemic makes the class divisions that have torn America's workers apart even harder to ignore, when some workers, ironically often the lowest paid, are deemed essential, and over 25 million Americans have lost their jobs, remember what workers must never forget. We are all in this together.
In our show today, Lori again interviews John Komorowski, the chief public defender for Whatcom County, about why public defenders are so important to the justice system.
I'm glad to have you back with us on We Do the Work. Welcome, John.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So in order to kick this off, let's do just a simple recap of where we left off. You made what I appreciated so much as an unapologetic declaration that the system, with all of its power and inertia, actually favors the prosecution and the guilt of the defendant. And you gave us some really eloquent examples of why public defense is so important.
About 80% of all charged crimes are handled by public defense, which tells you that 80% of those individuals are unable to afford private counsel without substantial hardship to themselves. What happens if you don't have an adequately sourced public defense bar is essentially what we like to refer to as guilty plea mills. Okay? And for a guilty plea mill, let's look no farther than the city of Mount Vernon. There is a federal case, Wilbur versus City of Mount Vernon, which was decided in the United States District Court, in which the court found that officials made choices in negotiating contracts and allocating funds to the extent that meeting with defendants was not profitable for counsel. Counsel was paid as little as $10 per case, and it gave counsel incentive to close cases as quickly as possible, therefore depriving indigents right here in the city of Mount Vernon of their Sixth Amendment right to counsel, despite appointing those counsel in a timely manner. Defenders in that case were assigned so many cases that the defendants often went to trial or accepted plea bargains without even meeting with an attorney. Now, that resulted in a settlement which requires a federal referee to come into the city of Mount Vernon in recognition of the fact that these people were being processed like sausage. Now, why does that happen? Keep in mind that this type of situation cannot happen without the acquiescence of the judges, which is completely scandalous because they have the ultimate obligation to ensure that the citizen receives due process. Keep in mind, this could not have happened without the acquiescence of the prosecuting attorneys who allowed it to happen. Keep in mind that it could not have happened without the active cooperation of the funding source, the city, who basically didn't give a gosh darn about the Sixth Amendment or providing justice to these people. And I'm ashamed to say this could not have happened without the acquiescence of the defense bar and the public defender contract in this particular case. So whereas standards say misdemeanor cases are supposed to be anywhere in the neighborhood of 300 to 400, these attorneys were doing over 1,000.
Wow.
Wow. Particularly wow for those people who I say were processed like Lamy. And we are sitting here right now, obviously,
right.
in Mount Vernon.
In Mount Vernon.
So you don't have to swing a cat very far to find these sorts of problems in the criminal justice system. A well-sourced criminal justice system, including well-sourced public defenders, saves money and actually saves cost. Of course, you just start out holistically from the idea that there should not be a price tag put on someone's constitutional rights, particularly when the government, the state, is looking to lock them up. It costs approximately $29,000 a year to put somebody in prison. That breaks down to about $2,416 a month, and that's $1,100 per taxpayer. That is an awful lot of money that we spend on prisons. Adequately sourced public defenders keep the system honest. It also helps to eliminate people pleading guilty to crimes that they didn't commit. The overall rate, as it has been studied, of innocent people pleading guilty is between 2 and 8%. Now, that doesn't necessarily seem like a whole lot, although you may ask, how many innocent people are we going to tolerate putting in our jails?
That's right.
But with over 2.2 million people in American prisons, 8% is a big number.
On that, we're going to have to let it go for today. But John, I have learned so much in these two opportunities to talk to you about the justice system and the necessity to have adequate law enforcement, prosecution, and defense. I want to thank you. I hope our listeners have learned as much as I have. This is Lori Province, We Do the Work, signing off.
See you next week. And remember, educate, agitate, mobilize, and organize.
We wrap up this week's show with an excerpt from a recent podcast extra from the En Masse podcast, as host Liz Medina, who's also acting director of the Vermont AFL-CIO, joined other speakers and singer Heidi Ann Wilson during a Protect the Results vigil in front of Vermont State House on November 4th.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Liz Medina. I'm the acting director of Vermont AFL-CIO. I'm a union sister with UAW 2322, and like many here, I'm a deeply concerned citizen. From listening to our brothers, sisters, and siblings, and looking around here tonight, I know there are a lot of patriots in this state. Yes, patriots. Patriots because we support our country and its most sacred document, our Constitution. The preamble of our Constitution enshrines our democracy, our popular sovereignty, with those famous, beautiful words, "We the people." In fact, if you take a look at our Constitution, you'll notice that "we the people" are the biggest words on it. We the people are here to protect our country's sovereignty. Because who's in charge of this country? That's right, we are, we the people.
This song is a song of hope, but it's something even bigger than hope. No matter what happens, it's sort of like the belief and the faith in the world turning and in our capacity to see the dearness in one another. The words are, hold on, my dear ones, here comes the dawn. And I'll just keep singing it and join in whenever you're ready. Or whenever you're not ready.
Hold on, hold on, my dear ones, here
That's it. Hold on, hold on, my dear ones, here comes the dawn. Yeah. Hold on, hold on, my dear ones, here comes the dawn. Hold on, hold on.
Wow, so amazing. What a lovely way to close out this edition of the Labor Radio Podcast Weekly. It's our roundup of highlights from the nearly 80 Labor Radio shows and podcasts, and I do hope you enjoyed our selections this week. The Labor Radio Podcast Network shows focus on working people's issues and concerns, and we've got links to all the network shows at laborradionetwork.org. You can also find them by using the hashtag Labor Radio Pod on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Labor Radio Podcast Weekly was edited by Evan Papp and Patrick Dixon, produced by me, and our social media guru is Harold Phillips. You can follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Labor Radio Net and find out more on our website at laborradionetwork.org. For Labor Radio Podcast Weekly, this has been Chris Garlock, urging you to stay active and, of course, stay tuned to your local Labor Radio Podcast show. See you next week. Oh, almost forgot. Here's a bonus for those of you who've listened all the way through the show, the complete version of Take a Stand from the Kids United Nouvelle Generation.
My back is aching from a long day's work. There is so much that she must clean.
And her employers listen no kind words. For today she turns 13.
He has a story that millions of children share.
We must come together, for there's no time to spare.
Tunnels deep beneath the ground.
He doesn't always get the food he needs, but it's the only bed he's found.
He has a story that millions of children share.
We must come together,
for there's no time to spare.
Try labor to an end.
Russell Barton's family and crazy sin and sentence.
152 million. That's so many children.
Working hard, no golden one. When each of them should be in school.
Provide for those in poverty. Make school accessible and free.